BBC FM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to BBC FM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The secret rulers of the NATO world, the Bilderberg, are meeting as we speak near Washington in the heart of the military-industrial complex. Yes, the bankers, the royalty and a smattering of politicians. So who's there and why are the press and public both being kept away at the point of a machine gun? Plus, Operation Paperclip and the Nazi Capital flight scandal. Where did all the Nazi loot end up? Why did the Allies allow scores of Nazi war criminals and billions of dollars worth of Nazi loot to be smuggled out of Germany in the closing months of World War II? And where did it all end up? Martin Summers and I have a special report. Also, an antidote to the Diamond Jubilee, as we hear from the author of a new book on the death of Princess Diana, which uses evidence submitted to the inquest but never seen by the jury, on why he believes a senior royal gave the order to assassinate Diana and exactly when and why. Plus, Martin Summers' weekly roundup of global events, which is, I think, Martin, where we're going to start this week. And most importantly, I think it was really a week ago now, on Friday, this dreadful massacre in Syria. Can you just tell us a bit about what the impact of that has been?
Well, it's certainly being used as evidence that the Annan peace plan has failed. The Western powers are using this massacre. I mean, obviously we're getting various reports about what actually happened, and there's disputes about what actually happened, but basically the massacre has been definitely used by the Western powers as clear evidence that the peace plan being pushed by Kofi Annan has failed, and that therefore it's time for regime change in Syria. But of course the Russians aren't accepting that. They're saying that they want the Annan peace plan to succeed, and that they're pushing for the plan to be implemented.
But the Russians seem to be stonewalling here. Isn't it being pretty much proved that the people who did this massacre were in some way aligned with the Assad regime?
Well, the most convincing stuff I've read was today, which says that these are actually informal militias of Alawite people. Alawites are the Shias, who are the privileged ethnic group in Syria, because the Assad family belongs to that group, and that they went in and killed a lot of Sunni people.
Well, the UN is saying it suspects fighters known as Shabiha, yeah, acting on behalf of Assad's forces, which stormed the villages and killed the people.
There'd be like the UDA as opposed to the UDR, if you like, in Northern Irish terms. Of course, the Assad.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean the UDA was a semi illegal terrorist organisation, the Ulster Defence Association. The UDR, the Ulster Defence Regiment, was supposedly part of the British Army. So it looks like this is an informal militia that's carried this out rather than regular army soldiers. But the fact is that what the Assad regime is asserting, that they had nothing to do with it, and that in actual fact it was being carried out by Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists in order to discredit them. Now, actually, as the old adage has it, truth is the first casualty in any war, and we've certainly seen that in Syria. I mean, I picked up a story this week and sent it to you, that one of the pictures that the BBC were using as evidence for the massacre turned out to have been shot in Iraq in 2003. And so, what happens is that this gets circulated. I mean, dead bodies look like dead bodies.
Well, the BBC haven't reported this, but the Daily Telegraph did. It said the BBC is facing criticism after it accidentally used a picture taken in Iraq in 2003 to illustrate the senseless massacre of children in Syria. The photograph was actually taken by Marco Di Loro in Iraq in 2003. The photographer Marco Di Loro said he nearly fell out of his chair when he saw the image being used, and he said he was astonished at the failure of the corporation to check their sources.
Well, it may be that the BBC have made an honest mistake there, but somebody may be sitting there uploading these things to YouTube saying, look at this horrible picture of these dead people, and it's all the fault of that terrible Assad. Oh, no, it isn't, actually. It's a picture from years ago. Now, there is clearly psychological warfare operations going on.
The caption the caption on the photograph stated that it was provided by an activist and cannot be independently verified, but it said it is believed to show the bodies of children in Hula awaiting burial.
Now, what's going on there is that the BBC are possibly being fooled. Somebody says they're an activist from Hula, uploads the stuff to YouTube, and the BBC pick up on it. That just shows how easy it is to jump to judgment without knowing all the facts. Let's just be quite clear. What's going on in Syria is horrible. It's quite clear that the government are pretty brutal and ruthless, and that their opposition, who carried out various suicide attacks in the last few weeks, they're also pretty brutal and ruthless. It's not good guys with white hats versus bad guys with black hats. It's just everybody with black hats. That's what it looks like to me. That's what I saw in Bosnia years ago. That's usual in wars.
Now, Damascus is finding armed groups responsible for the Hula massacre, but the US does not believe it. This is the report by the Syrian government. They've looked into this, and they say over 3 days, and they say the report says that up to 800 rebel fighters were involved in this mass killing, a cluster of villages in Syria's western Homs province on May the 25th. General Qasim Jamal Suleiman, head of the investigative committee, said that there were families which refused to oppose the government and were at odds with the armed groups. Government forces did not enter the area, and when the massacre occurred, not before the massacre and not after it, Suleiman said. Foreign Ministry spokesman Jihad Makdisi said the aim was to create sedition in Syria, adding that people who are trying to ignite civil strife will not succeed. US representative in the United Nations, Susan Rice, called Syria's preliminary report on the Hula massacre a blatant lie.
I think everybody's accusing everybody else of lying. I think the fact is that nobody disputes that suicide bombs carried out in Damascus and Aleppo, which killed scores of people, and they were clearly the opposition. Now, in actual fact, what it seems to me is both the opposition and the government in Syria are losing all sense of moral proportion, and basically ordinary people are being caught up in the middle between a brutal government and a brutal insurgency. But normal stuff around the world, actually.
We'll see today what happens, because the UN Human Rights Council is gathering today for a special session to address the massacre and present their findings. However, the information on which the UN body bases its conclusions and the way it was obtained may raise questions. Marinella Correggia, who's an activist from the No War Network, told the Russian channel Russia Today that the UN body questioned opposition only whom they reached by phone.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget there is psychological warfare going on. There's an attempt. The Assad regime is pretty authoritarian, but at the same time, the attempts to make them. I mean, for example, I'll put it to you this way: how much have we heard about massacres in Yemen this week? There have been massacres in Yemen, but we've heard nothing, because the Yemeni government is aligned with the West. So what they do is not something that concerns us, and we're not being frightened about it on the news every night. Syria is being picked out because it's an anti-Western regime. There are pro-Western regimes across the Middle East who are killing people, but we're not hearing about what they're doing because, well, that would be impolite.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
And Israel is hinting that it may be behind the Flame supervirus, which is targeting Iran. Flame cyber attacks that can steal vast amounts of sensitive data are coming as the Tehran nuclear talks falter. This is a top Israeli minister yesterday feeding speculation the Jewish state could be responsible for a powerful new virus said to have been used in a fresh attack on computers in Iran and elsewhere in the Middle East. The discovery of the unprecedentedly complex data-stealing Flame virus was disclosed by a Russian-based digital security firm Kaspersky Lab. Its experts reported on Monday that it had been applied most actively in Iran, but also in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, Sudan, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. Moshe Yalon, Israel's vice prime minister and strategic affairs minister, told the country's army radio, "Anyone who sees the Iranian threat as a significant threat, it's reasonable to assume that he will take various steps, including these, to harm it."
Yes, I mean, they're basically all but admitting that they were behind this. I sent you something earlier, Tony, from the New York Times, where a New York Times reporter, on the basis of inside information, says that the Stuxnet virus was definitely created by the Americans and the Israelis. This was sent in to wreck Iran's centrifuges in their nuclear program. But the bad news is that the Stuxnet virus then got into the whole of the internet and may have had a hand, been a part of the Fukushima meltdown. So this kind of cyber war is not harmless. If you try and wreck somebody else's nuclear power plants, that's a potentially very dangerous thing to do. And if you have a cyber war virus which wrecks Iran's nuclear power plants and then it escapes, I think the phrase used in the article is it's like a zoo animal finding the key to the cage, then it's rampaging around in everybody's computer systems, including the Japanese computer systems, and it may, in fact, the Stuxnet virus may have played a role in the Fukushima meltdown. Isn't that fantastic? I mean, the Americans and the Israelis are admitting that they are using cyber war against nuclear targets. That is the height of irresponsibility. How irresponsible is that?
Totally. Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
On now, I suppose, then, to the main news of the day, certainly from my point of view, which is this Bilderberg conference that's going on right now over in just outside Washington in Chantilly. Martin, it's a bit of an unprecedented situation, I believe, that the list of attendees has been released actually before the conference takes place. Normally, these Bilderberg meetings, which are made up of royalty, basically the top industrialists, that is to do with the boss of Shell, BP, as well as the heads of all of the main banks in the Western world, that is including, of course, the European Central Bank and the IMF and these people, they are, and royalty, they are normally... We have to wait until after the conference, until after everybody has left, before the list is released. Now, you've got the list there in front of you, and so have I. We've got some quite interesting people who are in this Bilderberg meeting. But first of all, can you just put it in context? This is a secret meeting. The press aren't allowed in. They're kept out at the point of a machine gun. Yet there are press inside, aren't there? There are some, for example, Marcus Agius, who's a trustee of the BBC and also the chairman of Barclays Bank. He's sitting in that conference now.
Yes, and as you all know, Tony, as an avid Bilderberg watcher of many years, for many years the Bilderberg group pretended they didn't exist at all. There is no conference. This is all a conspiracy theory. There is a conference. This is all a load of nonsense, blah, blah, blah. And now, of course, they've realised that they've been rumbled. So I suppose that the issuing of the list is an attempt to settle that criticism. It's not secret. We've given you the list of who's attending. And I noticed that Henry Kissinger is in here, Richard Pearl, the heads of various banks... various politicians. You know, these are some of the most powerful people in the world. I noticed there's some Russians included in this, but Garry Kasparov, who's very definitely an anti-Putin person, is there.
I
haven't had a proper look. Li Cheng, Director of Research, Brookings Institution. I thought he might be from China.
The Brookings Institution, for example. I mean, a lot of these kind of things come up. I've been to a couple of these conferences, and you often see these people
coming in and out.
They did ask, but they wouldn't allow me to do a talk there. They came out, and they were going in, but you look at these people and you think, well, you seem like a very sort of powerful person. You're head of a bank, but I have no idea who you are, and you don't often recognise them. Another person here, although they're put down as an international delegate, is one somebody from Syria, but they're not actually part of Syria itself, the Syrian government. They're a kind of westernised opposition. I mean, basically, he is here. Kodimani Basema, that's Basema actually is his first name, Kodimani is his second name. He's a member of the Executive Bureau and head of Foreign Affairs for the Syrian National Council.
Syrian National Council is the opposition.
Yes,
in Syria.
So they're not really interested, it doesn't seem, in dialoguing with the Syrian regime. It's the opposition in certain countries.
Well, as you called it,
and the Russians.
But the Russians that they've invited are the anti-Putin people. Garry Kasparov here is very United Civil Front of Russia, so they've not, in fact, and Rus Ivanov, associate member, Russian Academy of Sciences, president, Russian International Affairs Council. I don't know who he is. He might be a pro-Putin person. I doubt it. This is NATO. This is the power structure of NATO, as you pointed out earlier, with a few other people tacked on who they want to talk to.
But let's run through some of the people who it's been we have been blessed with this list of who's actually there. First of all, we've got Keith B. Alexander, who's the commander of US Cyber Command, the director of the National Security Agency.
Well, he may be responsible for both Stuxnet and Flame, and possibly Fukushima, as we were saying earlier.
We have then from Belgium, His Royal Highness Prince Philippe of Belgium.
Well, I don't know much about him, but as you say, I mean, I find the presence of royalty here rather anomalous, but I believe that they are there as a kind of a glue. The royalty creates a kind of a glue for the elite to coagulate around. I can't imagine that they have that much power. I mean, I think the heads of banks and the military are probably going to be calling the shots rather than the royalty.
Well, that's not the case for Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands,
no.
Because she's one of the major, if not the main, shareholders in Royal Dutch Shell. We've also got the boss of Shell and the boss of BP.
Yeah.
But, I mean, looking at particularly at the British participants, we've got Nick Bowles, who's a British Conservative Member of Parliament. He's famous for saying on Question Time that he thought that the whole phone hacking thing, this is back in about 2008, was a storm in a teacup and really brushing it all under the carpet.
Well, we've also got Kenneth Clark, Lord Chancellor and Secretary of Justice, and we know that when George Osborne attended the Bilderberg Conference last year, when it was it in Switzerland? I can't remember now.
Yeah, it's in St Moritz.
In St Moritz, he took his Treasury team with him. Now, actually, we cannot stop the wealthy and the powerful having private meetings. But when politicians who are supposed to be our representatives, like Kenneth Clark, turn up to this meeting, I want to know whether Kenneth Clark is there in our time or his time. Did he go, did he take holiday to go to this? Because if he's going to go in our time, I want a report from him about what happened in the meeting. I want to see minutes. And George Osborne took his Treasury team with him last year. He tried to pretend that he was going as a private individual to the meeting, but he took his Treasury team with him, civil servants.
So what's the problem with that, though?
Well, the problem with that is that we pay for those civil servants. We can't stop Henry Kissinger as a private individual and the heads of various banks as private individuals having a meeting. We can't stop Mandelson going now because he's not... he's a member of the House of Lords. Perhaps we should be. I mean, basically, these people who are representing us, if they go to these meetings, I want to know what they're up to. And I also want to know whether they're going in their time or our time. So when Kenneth Clark is at this meeting this weekend, are we paying him or is he there in his own time? I want to know, because if we're paying him, I want to know what went on in the meeting. And if we're not paying him, we still want to know that he went. And it's important that people do know that the Kenneth Clark, the Member of Parliament, Lord Chancellor, Secretary of Justice, is going to a private meeting where we're not allowed to know what goes on, meeting all the big movers and shakers from the military, industrial complex and the banks. And that is the problem with the politicians.
Well, particularly with Kenneth Clark, looking at what he's up to, he's just announced that civil courts will hear evidence in secret over here for the first time in order to protect national security. Evidence deemed sensitive to national security by judges will be heard behind closed doors in a controversial move that will make legal history. The Justice Secretary is making some sort of a climb down, however, by excluding inquests from these new powers.
Well, yes.
I mean, the reason that is because military families have kicked up a stink because
indeed.
They don't want inquests into their loved ones' deaths to be held in secret.
Indeed. And was that discussed at last year's Bilderberg meeting, perhaps? And was Kenneth Clark attending either this year's or last year's Bilderberg meeting in his capacity as a private individual or in his capacity as a British government minister? This has got to be cleared up. I don't. We can't stop the wealthy and the powerful from going to these meetings. But I would also say that this guy who's head of the National Security Agency, US Cyber Command, is he being paid by the US taxpayer to be there, or is he there as a private individual? Because if he's there as a member of the US, paid for by the US taxpayer, I want to know what happened in the meeting if I was a US taxpayer. You are being paid by me to go to this meeting. I want to see what you were talking about. Don't tell me it's a secret. I'm not interested in hearing that.
Okay, another attendee is Michael J. Evans, who's the Vice Chairman and the Global Head of Growth Markets at Goldman Sachs and Company. Now, Goldman Sachs are...
The vampire squid on the face of humanity, isn't that?
Well, that's one way to put it. But Goldman Sachs, what's been in their involvement? Because people are saying that Goldman Sachs have actually been involved in appointing prime ministers in Greece and Italy.
Well, exactly. And where do they decide who they're going to appoint? Why, at the Bilderberg meeting. And this Bilderberg meeting is not the only meeting of the transnational elite. There are others, even more secret. But this is one of the more important ones. And what it is, I mean, as our friend Webster Tarpley in the US says, Bilderberg is not where they decide the line, it's where they distribute the line. So the politicians go to Bilderberg to be told what to do by the real power brokers, the military and the banks. And both politicians are there to get their instructions. But they should be getting their instructions from us and not from them.
Now, another interesting person who's there is Ying Fu, who's the Vice Minister for Foreign Affairs for China. Now, he looks like quite a big hitter. We had the Chinese turning up at Bilderberg for the first time, it seems, last year.
Yeah.
Do you think there's an attempt to sort of outflank the Russians by getting the Chinese on board? Because we've also heard the Chinese have just decided that they're going to be privatising their previously state-owned banks in China.
Well, it may be so, but it really depends on whether this guy, Igor Ivanov, is a pro-Putin loyalist or is an oppositionist in Russia. Now, one of the other things that, I mean, if you think about it for a minute, getting all the biggest movers and shakers of the planet all in one place for a weekend is not necessarily a bad idea. The problem is the secrecy, and the question is, what are they deciding behind those closed doors? They ought to come out at the end of it, like they do at the G8 or the G20, with a communique and say, this is what we've been talking about, but they won't.
Well, okay, but tell us more about the Chinese presence, because it is a pretty totalitarian state, China, and they are starting to come around to the Western point of view. Do you think Bilderberg may have played a part in this, certainly from an economic...
They will be supporting the right-wing faction in the Communist Party in China, which wants to move towards a more market-oriented policy, and they'll be trying to undermine those who are opposed. And the same goes for the Russians. They will presumably be those who are likely to be opposing the current regime in Russia. Although they may have invited people who they don't agree with in order to sort of, you know, find out what they think and bend their ear. But the fact of the matter is that this is the secret government of the world. If you've got the Chinese and the Russians in there as well, well, it really is the top guys from everywhere, isn't it?
We also got John Kerry. And it says here, Senator for Massachusetts. But I think he was a bit bigger than that, wasn't he, really?
Well, he was a US presidential candidate. He was not unsuccessful. He actually won. Bush didn't just steal the 2000 election. He stole the 2004 election as well by hacking into the computers in Ohio, which is a spring state. And Kerry, of course, who's a skull and bones man, which means he's part of the Yale secret society that Bush is part of, should have contested that. But he didn't. He threw in the towel like a good little boy. No doubt, because at Bilderberg the previous year he'd been told that that's what he ought to do.
Now, Henry A. Kissinger, now he is one of the real central figures in all of this. He's been there right from the early days, and he was involved, he was a Secretary of State under Nixon, wasn't he, during Vietnam. But it seems that he can't keep his hand out of the whole, of the sort of political arena. Tell us a bit about Kissinger. What kind of guy is he?
Well, I mean... Christopher Hitchens, before he lost his marbles, wrote a very good book on Kissinger. Kissinger is effectively a war criminal. He should be at The Hague for the bombing of Cambodia and the overthrowing of the government of Chile in the 1970s. Nevertheless, he's not in prison. He's at Bilderberg calling the shots, as he always has.
But, I mean, you know, surely he's just a sort of retired person. He's got a bit of a interest in world affairs. He's entitled to go along to something like this,
isn't
he?
He's a private individual, and we can't stop him going. But I question what Kenneth Clark is doing there on my money.
All right, just flicking over the page to the next lot of characters who are there. We've got from Britain, we've got Peter Mandelson. He's definitely there. He's been several times before. Mandelson is now in the House of Lords, but he was discredited three times, wasn't he, when he was an MP?
Well, he used to attend Bilderberg when he was an MP, and again, I ask the same question. Did he attend as an MP or did he attend as an individual? And even if he attended as an individual... We still want to know what you're doing there.
The trouble is...
I question what the politicians are doing there. The politicians are being taken to this place to be told what to do by the real masters of the universe, the banks and the military-industrial complex. That's what's going on at Bilderberg. It's like a hot gypsy horse fair where they hire and fire the political leadership.
The Financial Times, there's quite a lot of media people there too, from Google and from LinkedIn. This is an extension over the last 3 or 4 years. We've seen many more people like Amazon. Facebook, it seems, are not there this year, although they were last year, and they've now sort of gone through the Bilderberg process, I suppose, of floating their company on the stock market, which hasn't been particularly successful. But what's the significance of having these internet firms there, Martin?
Well, because we've got the head of cyber warfare for the US military there, and how do you do cyber warfare? Well, it's with the internet, so there you go. And also, the internet is the cause of the crisis, in the sense that the dot-com bubble, where everybody thought they were all going to get rich by being internet entrepreneurs, and it all turned very sour, that's the root cause of the crisis.
But probably the most important person is Kenneth Clark, because not only is he there now at this particular Bilderberg conference, and he's very, very active in dismantling some of the basic fundamentals of justice here in Britain, as we've just heard, but he's also on this thing called the Bilderberg Steering Committee. The Bilderberg do say that this is their only annual activity, and yet quite clearly it isn't, because the Bilderberg Steering Committee is meeting during the year in order to discuss who to invite to these events.
Exactly.
And he, along with Marcus Agius, who is from the BBC and also the chairman of Barclays, Ken Clark is one of the main people on this steering committee. So could you just give us an idea of, you know, what that tells us about how Bilderberg operates? Because well, the very start, as they're saying that this is their only activity. It clearly isn't.
Well, as I understand it, if you get invited to a Bilderberg conference, you get given a briefing paper explaining what the policy is that is going to be discussed, and you have got to make your contribution fit in with the policy that's already been decided by the steering committee. So we've got the big long list of people invited, but the steering committee have already decided what the agenda is that will be discussed. And if you ask me what's on this agenda this year, I would say it's a banking collapse and a Middle East war. Most likely, that's what they'll be talking about.
And the other thing is, there's another story running alongside this, which is, I think, fascinating, which is the Rothschild and the Rockefeller families this week, it's been announced, are teaming up for some extra wealth creation. The Rothschild and Rockefeller families have teamed up to buy assets from banks and other distressed sellers in a union between two of the best-known names in financial history. This is the business editor of The Telegraph, Alastair Osborne. RIT Capital Partners, which is chaired by Lord Rothschild, has taken a 37% stake in Rockefeller Financial Services, the family's wealth advisory and asset management wing. It snapped up the holding from the French bank Societe Generale for less than £100 million. The transatlantic alliance cements a five-decade acquaintance between the now ennobled Jacob Rothschild, who's 76, and David Rockefeller, who's 96, the grandson of the ruthlessly acquisitive American oil man and philanthropist John D. Rockefeller. The two patricians now plan to capitalise on their family names to buy other asset managers or their portfolios, using the network of top-notch contacts to ensure they get a seat at the table for any deal.
Well, as Adam Smith says in The Wealth of Nations, businessmen very rarely get together, even on social occasions, without some conspiracy against the public being discussed.
But these two dynasties, they were both family dynasties, the Rothschilds in Britain and the Rockefellers. We don't really see, for example, the Rothschilds mentioned on the rich list. We had Kevin Cahill here last week, and he made it very clear that nowadays many of the super rich actually won't even be on the rich list because they keep their wealth in tax havens and they keep it hidden.
Yes, I mean, people who want to be on the rich list are people like footballers and self-made millionaires, because they're keen to be seen to be rich. The super rich actually are keen to be invisible.
And the connection here is that the Rothschilds, I think it's Evelyn de Rothschild, who was the previous head after Jacob Rothschild took over, have certainly been along to several of these Bilderberg conferences and are said to be very influential in the steering committee and in appointing who's in charge. Victor Rothschild before, of course, was quite notorious in the 1960s and 70s as being involved in the Wilson plot, for example, and also in Peter Wright's book Spycatcher. He says that Victor Rothschild was basically telling the government who to appoint as the head of the British Security Services.
Well, this is the suspicion about Bilderberg. It's a private club of wealthy people who decide the policy for the rest of the rest of humanity. And if Al-Qaeda really existed, which of course it doesn't, apart from as a puppet of Western intelligence services, they'd plant a nice big car bomb there and kill a lot of them, wouldn't they, if they really existed, they don't.
Well, going back to the origins of the Bilderbergs, I think one of the things that really flagged it up to me as something dodgy to begin with was this character, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, because he was the first chairman of Bilderberg, but he was also, in his early days, certainly back in Germany, he was a German prince who married into the Dutch royal family. He was... Not only was he an SS officer, but he was also in the Nazi Party, but he also denied being in the Nazi Party. I mean, do you think I'm over-egging the pudding by saying that we should be looking at this guy and seeing what was it appropriate for him to be chairing this kind of thing?
I think we can perhaps move on to the Martin Bormann book at the moment. Is that okay? I mean, I've got this book here, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, published in 1981. He's a very senior US journalist. And the main thesis of the book is that Martin Bormann, who was second in command to Hitler, did not die in Berlin in 1945. He actually went to Latin America, and where he was living until the mid late 80s, running an organisation dealing with all of the assets of Nazi Germany, which were basically spirited out of the country and then basically used to build up a huge international financial organisation.
I think we're going to have to use that as a bit of a teaser, Martin, because before we do that, we're not going to leave the Bilderberg book for a moment, okay. Because I spoke earlier this week to the author Stephen Dorrell about the Bilderbergs and asked him about what he thought of it all. He's someone who had a very close look at MI6. He did MI6, 50 Years of Special Operations was one of his books. But here's Stephen Dorrell's take on the Bilderbergers, who's a professor of journalism, I think, up at Huddersfield University now.
I'm Stephen Dorrell, a senior lecturer in journalism at Huddersfield University. My last book was Black Shirt, Sir Oswald Mosley and British Fascism. I'm currently working on Gladio, story of MI6 and the European stay behind units after the Second World War, which is due to come out at the beginning of next year. We live in an age of transparency, and it should be much more open. And it does seem that this group, Bilderberg, has gone on for far too long, because we also have the Trilateral Commission, which is a more global thing. And there are other formats and other conferences where they do this kind of thing. But this has always been a very intimate, small scale. It is about some of the groups in the Cold War that created networks that ran through politicians, intelligence and industry that were working closely together. And they have a particular view of the world, which they largely share. The problem with groups like the Bilderberg is, unless there's some kind of crisis, which was during McCarthyism and there may be now, then they tend to have a fairly safe kind of groupthink.
One of the key people at these conferences is Henry Kissinger, who has rather a dodgy record, particularly with the coup in Chile in the 70s. And then there's also the fact that they basically say, we've got all these rich and powerful people here, just trust us, we're just chatting about things behind the scenes for your benefit. But as we see now, the financial situation is in a total mess. I mean, we've got most of the people who are responsible for these big financial institutions in there talking in secret. It doesn't exactly encourage enthusiasm for the public about trusting them.
Absolutely. I think we should just dismiss Kissinger. We know what he did. I don't think he has any meaning anymore. He's simply a figure that they bring in because he's done it for so long. I don't think he has any influence or is anything important. The important people are the bankers and the financiers and the treasury people and the people at the top of government. These are the people that are not accountable, out of any kind of democratic accountability, and it's this lack of transparency. And it's an elite view of the world that elites can still have influence, and maybe they do through transnational companies, but it is fundamentally anti-democratic.
That's the author and professor of journalism at Huddersfield University, Stephen Dorrell there. Martin, I think one of the most interesting things Stephen's pointing out there, apart from me saying it's totally anti-democratic, not just undemocratic, but it's actually corrosively destroying democracy, is this whole idea of groupthink. Because there's a sort of supposed consensus which is within those four walls, behind those machine gun nests. What is this whole thing of groupthink?
Well, I mean, you know what the phrase groupthink means. It's they're trying to mould the...
This is from George Orwell's 1984, isn't it?
Well, no, groupthink is a standard thing that's used in all sorts of journalistic contexts. I think if you go back to Aristotle's Politics, he defined there are three basic types of political system. You've got monarchy, where one person rules. Perhaps you could say, I don't know, well, Saudi Arabia is a monarchy. You've got oligarchy, where a small group rules, usually the wealthy. This is what this is. And you've got democracy, which is supposedly where we get some kind of a say. And I think, in actual fact, it's an open secret that we don't live in a democracy. We live in an oligarchy. And the existence of the Bilderberg meeting spells it out, it shows it to people in words of fire 10 feet high. These are the people making the decisions. And if you think they're interested in what you think, you're kidding yourself. They don't care.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
On now then to look at Martin Bormann. Martin did give us a little, Martin Summers, that is, gave a little teaser earlier on about him. Martin, why do you think that this guy's significant? Certainly he was very close to Adolf Hitler through the Second World War, along with another sort of close deputy to Hitler, Rudolf Hess. But then Hess suddenly disappeared off the scene, and Bormann was definitely going to be
Hitler's right-hand man. And I've read this book, and it's very convincing. I mean, Paul Manning is a very serious journalist. He was a war correspondent in World War II. He knew all of the principals involved in World War II.
He was actually...
Churchill, you know, we're all very well.
Well, he was actually working for CBS News, and he was giving reports across, in fact, many times live from battle situations. Several times he actually went out with the American Air Force on bombing raids over Germany, and so he was quite well-known and well-respected.
Yeah, so he's a very credible journalist. And I find the book very convincing, and the main thesis of the book is that Martin Bormann, who was actually Hitler's right-hand man, Hitler was a bit of a flibbertigibbet. He used to just have mad rages and stay up all night rabbiting on. Bormann actually got things done. Yeah, so Bormann would take away from Hitler's rants and go away and actually do what Hitler wanted. So Bormann was second in command of the Nazi Party. So when Hitler committed suicide, he took command of the Nazi Party. And the Nazi Party continued to exist and moved most of its key personnel, and we're talking about several tens of thousands of people, to Latin America, down the rat lines. And then many others from the Nazi Party, and particularly from the intelligence services, like Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, he became the head of the West German secret police, the Bundespolice. The book basically makes a very strong case that lots of the assets of Germany were moved offshore at that stage to keep them out of the hands of the Western powers and the Russians, with the connivance of the Western powers, and then they were gradually brought back into Germany and rebuilt Germany after the war. Bormann was actually masterminding the rebuilding of the Federal Republic of Germany from Argentina.
Okay, now let me just hold you, let me just stop you there for a minute, Martin, because this whole process began actually back in early in 1944, mid-1944, with something called the Red House Meeting, which took place in Strasbourg. And now let's go over to Dave Emery, and we've got a clip of here of him discussing this meeting, the Red House Meeting, which took place in Strasbourg at the Maison Rouge Hotel. And Dave Emery runs a website. He's from California, and he runs a website called The Spitfire List. But he also does a weekly podcast on these sorts of topics, and this was one from a few years ago where he explains that there was a concentrated effort after D-Day. Bormann and Hitler, and well, not necessarily Hitler, but certainly Bormann,
out of the loop.
Bormann and other Nazis realised that they were going to lose the war, and they wanted to make sure they got as much of the loot out of Germany as possible by the time the Allies reached Berlin.
Hitler, his intuitions at peak level despite his crumbling physical and mental health in the last years of the Third Reich, realized this and approved of it. "Bury your treasure," he advised Bormann, "for you will need it to begin a Fourth Reich," unquote. That is precisely what Bormann was about when he set in motion the Flight Capital Scheme August 10, 1944 in Strasbourg. The treasure, the golden ring he envisioned for the new Germany, was the sophisticated distribution of national and corporate assets to safe havens throughout the neutral nations of the rest of the world. Martin Bormann knew in his heart that the war in Germany was over when Normandy was lost. The day Hitler's troops were defeated at the Falaise Gap was the day he ordered swing industrialists of Germany to Strasbourg to hear his plans for Germany's future. And Paul Manning writes of this meeting in Strasbourg as follows. Reichsleiter Martin Bormann himself had ordered the conference, and although he would not physically be present, he had confided to Dr. Scheid, that's S-C-H-E-I-D, who was to preside, quote, "The steps to be taken as a result of this meeting will determine the post-war future of Germany," unquote. The Reichsleiter had added, quote, "German industry must realize that the war cannot now be won and must take steps to prepare for a post-war commercial campaign which will in time ensure the economic resurgence of Germany," unquote. It was August 10th, 1944. The Mercedes-Benz bearing SS Obergruppenführer Scheid moved slowly now through the narrow streets of Strasbourg. Dr. Scheid noticed that this was the most agreeable city, the one to return to after the war. And skipping down of the meeting, Manning writes, "A transcript of that meeting is in my possession. It is a captured German document from the files of the U.S. Treasury Department and states who was present and what was said as the economy of the Third Reich was projected onto a post-war profit-seeking track. By the way, this document emerged as part of Operation Safe Haven, an Allied intelligence operation aimed at interdicting the Third Reich's flight capital. That operation was itself interdicted when the residue of the Third Reich allied with the United States, Britain, and France in the post-war period. That alignment, of course, against the former Soviet Union. Continuing, of the meeting, Manning writes, present were Dr. Kaspar, representing Krupp, Dr. Tolle, representing Rohling, Dr. Sincerin, representing Messerschmitt, Drs. Kopp, Veer, and Berwanger, representing Rheinmetall, Captain Haberkorn and Dr. Ruhe, representing Busing, Drs. Ellenmayer and Cardos, representing Volkswagenwerk, Engineers Drosse, Janchu, and Kopschem, representing various factories in Posen, Poland, Drosse, Janchu and Company, Braun Boveri Herculeswerke, Buchswerke, and Stadtwerke, Dr. Meyer, an official of the German Naval Ministry in Paris, and Dr. Stroessner of the Ministry of Armament, Paris. By the way, I may be mispronouncing some of these names. I don't speak German. Continuing. Dr. Scheid, papers from his briefcase arranged neatly on the table before him, stated that all industrial materiel in France was to be evacuated to Germany immediately. The Battle of France is lost to Germany, he admitted, quoting Reichsleiter Bormann as his authority, and again quoting, and now the defense of the Siegfried Line and Germany itself is the main problem. From now on, German industry must take steps in preparation for a post-war commercial campaign, with each industrial firm making new contacts and alliances through foreign firms.
Okay, a post-war industrial campaign, Martin, cooked up at this Red House meeting.
Yes, and there's a lot of evidence in the book for this taking place. If I could just give a little quote from the book, which is I think the most interesting paragraph in the book, actually. Since the founding of the State of Israel, the Federal Republic of Germany has paid out 85.3 billion marks by the end of 1977 to survivors of the Holocaust. East Germany ignores any such liability. From South America, where payment must be made with subtlety, the Bormann organization has made a substantial contribution. It has drawn many of the brightest Jewish businessmen into a participatory role in the development of many of its corporations, and many of these Jews share their prosperity most generously with Israel. If their proposals are sound, they are even provided with a specially dispensed venture capital fund. I spoke with one Jewish businessman in Hartford, Connecticut. He had arrived there quite unknown several years before our conversation, but with Bormann money as his leverage. Today he's more than a millionaire, a quiet leader in the community with a certain share of his profits earmarked, as always, for his venture capital benefactors. This has taken place in many other instances across America and demonstrates how Bormann's people operate in the contemporary commercial world, in contrast to the fanciful nonsense with which the Nazis are described in so much literature. So much emphasis is placed on select Jewish participation in Bormann companies that when Adolf Eichmann was seized and taken to Tel Aviv to stand trial, it produced a shockwave in the Jewish and German communities of Buenos Aires. Jewish leaders informed the Israeli authorities in no uncertain terms that this must never happen again. Now, in other words, money talks. Nazi money talks. And Nazi money can buy Jewish leaders, can buy the Israelis. And that's the world we live in. And no doubt there will be somebody representing the Bormann organization in Bilderberg, and they will be reporting back to the organization still based in Latin America. Bormann himself is dead. The organization carries on.
Now, back in 1999, I actually did a visit over to the United States, and I spoke then to the head of something called Trident Research and Recovery, which is a research company that works with people that do maritime salvage. And this is Ed Michaud, who I spoke to, and he had done quite a lot of research into this similar stuff. I mean, there's a lot of people in the United States who are very much aware that there was a kind of shadow kind of Nazi organization, including John Loftus, who we've had on this program, who was charged by Jimmy Carter to as a special investigator for the FBI to look into all this sort of thing. Martin, can you just tell us about who some of the key figures were in the United States who were actually really in cahoots with Bormann and
ilk? Ultimately, it's the roots of the Cold War. I mean, James G. Zangleton at the CIA, John Foster Dulles and others, as the war was coming to an end, they realised from their point of view that they were going to fight the Russians, and therefore they decided that they were going to make friends with various selected Nazis, and they did.
Anyway, so one of the most fascinating things is what happened to all those Nazi gold bars that were smuggled in submarines and things across the Atlantic to South America?
We've confirmed at least three U-boat missions to South America carrying securities under what the Allies call safe haven and what the Germans call Aktenfuhrland. We don't know which U-boats, but we do know they arrived, and we have Argentine intelligence documents confirming that they were spotted unloading actual securities. And there are records existing of the securities deposit in the Banco Alamein Transatlantico and the Banco Tornquist in downtown Buenos Aires, facilitated by the Sullivan Cromwell offices, which is a law firm that just happens to be Alan Dulles' law firm. So
what happened to this money? Any idea?
Oh, it disappeared. Even today's recent inquiries on the Holocaust Assets Inquiry conducted by the State Department failed to address entirely the Argentine involvement of these securities. We find that very interesting. We have very strong indication. In fact, there is actually proof that a lot of these securities actually were transferred later to New York City at the Federal Reserve in New York. And when that happened, that was 1950, they were subsequently re-smelted in the USSA bars from Nazi gold bars. The U.S. Federal Reserve did this now. That's documented. And they were sent on to Germany in 1950. There's your great German rebuilding program right there. Nazi money used to rebuild Germany with U.S. complicity.
So you think that there was some kind of relationship then between people like the Dulles brothers and some German industrialists?
Most definitely. There is no doubt about that. All of the history about the Dulles brothers, both Alan and John Foster, and their relationships with all the German industrialists that we've researched are very positive, very firm. They represented them in numerous lawsuits before and after the war. No doubt about it. Even the head of the Bank for International Settlements, McKittrick, Thomas McKittrick, was Alan Dulles' personal client in 1946. And BIS, as everyone knows, was very guilty of laundering Nazi money before, during, after the war.
Now, that BIS that Ed Michaud was talking about there, Martin, they were actually set up to do the German war reparations after the First World War.
That's correct.
And then ended up actually laundering Nazi money. Now, at the Bretton Woods Conference after World War II, there was a resolution passed to close it down, yet it still exists to this day. In Switzerland, it's called the Tower of Basel.
Well, do you want me to comment? Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that gangsters are gangsters, and sometimes they fight each other, and sometimes they do deals. As I pointed out in the extract I just read from Paul Manning's book, the modern Nazis are perfectly happy to do business with the State of Israel and with Jewish people. They're not prejudiced. They're just after money. And, of course, power.
And what about Alan and John Foster Dulles that he was talking about? Who are these characters?
Well, they're very powerful movers and shakers.
They were, anyway,
yeah,
after the Second
World
War.
If they were alive today, they'd be at the Bilderberg meeting, but they're not. But their successors are. If we look through that list in Bilderberg, we could try and spot who the Bormann people are. They'll be the German industrialists.
Now, also, of course, the German Central Bank, they are present at these meetings, the Bundesbank. How does this work, then? Is there a sort of separate individual German bank and a separate Euro bank? How does it work these days?
Yes. There are two separate banks. I mean, we've got...
What's the relationship, then, between the German Central Bank and the giant European Central Bank?
Well, I mean, the Bundesbank had a great deal of influence on the rules and regulations that underpin the European Central Bank, so that when François Hollande went to Germany the other week to ask Frau Merkel to allow the European Central Bank to print bonds on its own behalf, she said, no, it's not in the treaty. I mean, the Bundesbank insisted that the European Central Bank should not be able to print money like the Bank of England does, and she says, it's not in the articles of the setting up of the European Central Bank. The Bundesbank were very influential in writing those articles, because the Germans were only prepared to give up the Deutschmark if the European Central Bank was basically a clone of the Bundesbank, which it is, and that of course is causing some problems now, because they won't allow them to print any money, unlike the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England, who are basically printing money hand over fist.
Okay, so what's the relationship, if there is any, between what's going on now with the Western military industrial complex in the NATO zone, very much targeting, along with the Western mainstream media, looking at Iran and Syria and saying, well, look, these guys are really bad guys, and there may have to be military intervention?
Well, what we're seeing is the ruling class of the West getting together and making its plan for world domination, and the kind of people they are the kind of people they are. They've always been there behind the scenes. they regard themselves as the people who are naturally to rule the world, and they attempt to do so.
Well, I must say, I was quite chuffed yesterday to see an article in the Daily Mail about the Bilderberg conference, because it's certainly the first time that's happened. It's only really in the British press been talked about online, either on the BBC website online, which happened once about 7 or 8 years ago, and Charlie Skelton and his Guardian coverage online, which I must say is the best coverage as far as I'm concerned. You've got to go to the Guardian website to find out what's really going on at the Bilderberg meeting. But one of the things that frustrates me about what's going on at the moment is the massive censorship that's going on of the Iranian press TV channel, because, I mean, you were on there, for example, Martin, last year, and I thought what we'd do today is dip into to hear one of the voices that we're not hearing at all in the British mainstream media, and what we would be hearing if press TV was still being allowed to broadcast, and that's Gordon Duff from Veterans Today. Can you just tell us a little bit about him before we hear
him?
Well,
he's an ex-US Marine veteran. He was injured in Vietnam. He's in a wheelchair. And he's now senior editor of Veterans Today, and one of the scourges of the establishment in the United States, although he's got plenty of intelligence service contacts.
I spent the last 2 years involved in a study with a number of senior government intelligence agents with and without this government, and through NATO and else and otherwise. And we've been trying to look to the heart of why the U.S. is behaving such as it is. It has to be fairly obvious that the drone strikes are destabilizing an ally, Pakistan, that they are, we've lost our 3,000th victim this week in Afghanistan, and if it weren't for drone strikes, the war would have ended years and years ago, and we could have gotten down to the $80 billion a year heroin business, which is our only reason for being in Afghanistan since our oil business there collapsed. The essential mistake in premise is that the United States is doing it. That's based on a false premise that the United States makes its own diplomatic decisions. It does not. The Israeli lobby controls the United States. The Israeli lobby takes directions from a group of international financial concerns. The wars are entirely predicated on the needs of a financial community that profits by destabilization. And until we begin speaking realistically, of course it's illegal what we're doing. Of course it is. Of course everyone in Waziristan carries a gun, has a beard, and can be considered militant. And if you invade any country on earth, people are going to shoot back. And if you consider people that resist terrorists, and here in the U.S., if you protest anything in the U.S., you can potentially be thought of now as the terrorist.
That's Gordon Duff from Veterans Today there, Martin, speaking on Press TV, which is now banned by Ofcom in Britain.
Yes, and he's speaking about these drone strikes in Pakistan. And as you know, a few weeks ago, there was a conference organised by BAE Systems and Bristol University in central Bristol of people from all over the world who build these drones. And I and others went down there, and we had a very noisy protest, a very good-natured protest, and we were so noisy that we managed to close the conference down and drive them away. And so it must have cost BAE Systems some money, and they weren't very happy about it. And nevertheless, I mean, the point about these drones is the democratically elected government of Pakistan has said, will you please stop killing our people with these drones? You've got no right to do it. There's no legal basis for what you're doing. Will you stop, please? And the British and the Americans just go, ha, ha, ha. Well, the obvious answer to that by the Pakistanis is to say, well, we're going to start killing people in Britain that we don't like. And you can go, ha, 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 to that, because we're on the brink of a world war and a banking collapse. That's what they'll be discussing at Bilderberg.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
But to wind up today, we're going to have a little look at the Diamond Jubilee celebrations. Well, personally, I think it's mainly a good excuse for a bit of a party, and certainly a couple of days off, Monday and Tuesday next week. But there is a book just out by John Morgan, and let's have a little listen to him now. He was being interviewed by Vinnie Eastwood, who's a New Zealander, and this is where the information that was given to the coroner's inquest on the death of Princess Diana starts to get rather interesting, because Morgan believes that he has pinned down almost the exact time and date, the 23rd of July 1997, up at Balmoral, at a meeting of something called the Way Ahead Group, where the decisions were made to assassinate Diana. So that's the controversial stuff going on in that book. But let's have a listen now to John Morgan and explaining why he thinks that is.
What happened was, after the holiday, when she took the boys to Muhammad, immediately after that, the relationship with Dodie developed. So even in those 3 days between the holiday in the south of France and the Way Ahead Group meeting that actually took place on July the 23rd, even in those 3 days, that relationship with Dodie was starting, and she was under surveillance by MI6, and that information about the developing relationship even would have been known to the royals. Plus, you know, William and Harry had been there when Diana and Dodie met as well at the villa. So the relationship with Dodie developed, and Diana, even before that, was planning to move to the US, so she would have been getting even further out of the Queen's orbit, more out of control, you know. So there was a build-up of factors there, and with the Diana-Dodie relationship, of course, you've got the potential for a Muslim to be the stepfather to the king, which is basically not acceptable as well. So that's a reason why she would be assassinated. That relationship was really moving quite quickly, actually, and there was an engagement ring that was purchased. They were about to get engaged. That's what the evidence points to, that when Diana died, they were about to get engaged. That would have been a building pressure as well, you know. But when you're looking at the motives, you know, I think the decision was made that she would be removed, assassinated. That decision was made somewhere in that late July area, so about a month before she actually died.
That was John Morgan there speaking to Vinnie Eastwood. And the book is called Princess Diana Inquest, The Untold Story. It's book 5, Who Killed Princess Diana? And as John Morgan was saying there, he believes that the decision was made at something called the Way Ahead Group meeting on the 23rd of July 1997 at Balmoral. Now, a lot of the royal staff said that the Way Ahead Group was just a place to schedule the various royals, making sure that they weren't clashing. But actually, leaks in the Daily Mirror and the Sunday Mirror beforehand made it absolutely clear that from the palace staff that Diana was going to be top of the agenda of that meeting. Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way, because Friday night is music night. We've got some music now. I've just been told Knott's going to be Pat Hart and his Fresh Blood Party crew. But anyway, thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, the new UKIP councillor for Bradley Stoke North, Ben Walker, and also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, we've got a Big Brother special. Has surveillance in Britain gone too far? Is the way